This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Cozy Bear strikes again.
First and foremost, everybody wants a cure, and so that's probably what they're after.
The Russian hacking group is allegedly targeting vaccine researchers. I'm Carol Hills. Australia wants to welcome people from Hong Kong fleeing the Chinese crackdown, especially those with certain job skills.
They do want to be in a freer country. They want to be in a democratic country. And we want to make it attractive for that super talent to consider Australia. And that's what these measures do.
And in Karachi, Pakistan, it gets hot.
You lie on your cold, air-conditioned marble floor with your cheek right on the ground and you pray.
A look at one man's quest to fight urban heat. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. A working coronavirus vaccine. It's something just about everyone agrees we need and fast. But today, intelligence agencies in the U.S., U.K., and Canada report that the Russian hacking group Cozy Bear is targeting researchers trying to develop one. Joining me now is John Hultquist. He's the director of intelligence analysis at the cybersecurity company FireEye. John, first of all, tell us about this hacking group, Cozy Bear. It's got a cute name, but what do we know about them?
Well, we've been tracking Cozy Bear for several years now. We know that they're a Russian actor that carries out classic espionage. They're there to quietly gather intelligence. And we've seen them do that against governments, think tanks, the military, diplomats. They were the second actor found in the DNC. And while one actor, APT-28 or Fancy Bear, was indicted for their role, these guys didn't really get indicted because what they were doing was really within international norms. And so we really think that Cozy Bear is sort of a classic intelligence collector. It's not really about, you know, making a splash or disrupting something. If you get targeted or hacked by these guys, you know, you may never know it.
But in this case, according to statements from the UK, US, and Canada, this hacking group, who is Cozy Bear, we think, has been targeting COVID-19 researchers. What methods do they use to target these researchers and their institutions?
So they're using a range of different vulnerabilities. Basically, they're bugs in the code that some outsider or adversary might be able to take advantage of to essentially gain access to a network. And that was the case here. They were using a series of different publicly known vulnerabilities. But they have a, you know, wide range of different tactics that we've seen them use before. Everything from using vulnerabilities like this to just sending spear phishing emails to vulnerable users.
And what is spear phishing?
Spear phishing is the sending of malicious emails. Maybe get you to click on a link or to download some program that's got malware in it.
So why would Cozy Bear be doing this? What's their motivation?
So they're not alone. So Russia, Iran, China, we've seen them all targeting organizations involved in COVID-19 research. Every nation on Earth right now has an existential need to treat this virus. Some of them have substantial private sector capability like there is in the West, and some are having to rely on their intelligence services to get an advantage. So we're talking about some of the usual suspects here, but we suspect that a lot of different intelligence services are carrying out espionage right now to essentially get their hands on a cure.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you think this is about kind of intellectual appropriation, getting information to use, as opposed to disrupting and wrecking information.
That's right. We don't think that this actor is there to disrupt the networks or destroy something. We've seen that from other actors, certainly, but we'd think that first and foremost, everybody wants a cure, and so that's probably what they're after.
You mentioned that other countries and groups are doing the same thing. What other countries are they?
Well, we definitely see Iran also targeting the pharmaceutical sector. They appear to be doing pretty much the exact same thing. We've seen China target research organizations. And outside of just targeting the COVID-19 cure, we've seen a lot of COVID-19 espionage, because a lot of these states want to know what the other state is thinking. We know this began as early as January. In January, we saw Vietnamese hackers targeting China, and they were essentially targeting the government in Wuhan. And we think they were essentially, at the time, trying to gather intelligence on the origins of COVID-19.
In this current case, what can the U.S., U.K., and Canada do to try to prevent or at least anticipate such attacks? How can they prevent this?
Well, I think they're doing it. I think this is a great example of proactive teamwork. So not only did they call Russia out for doing this, but the information they provided, it includes a lot of operational details that network defenders in places like the pharmaceutical industry or academia can actually take and use to defend themselves against actors like Cozy Bear.
John Hultquist is the director of intelligence analysis at the cybersecurity company FireEye. Thanks a lot, John.
My pleasure.
The whole world is watching for progress as scientists race to develop that much-needed vaccine. The U.S. biotech company Moderna seems to be taking the lead, with news that it's launching Phase 3 clinical trials this month. The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for the show and has been monitoring all the different players in this race. Alana, what's the latest?
So there are currently about 24 SARS-CoV-2 vaccines in development around the world that are already being tested in humans. And that's in addition to dozens more that are in earlier stages of development.
So that sounds like a really crowded race. How do we sort it out?
It is a crowded race. Scientists I've talked to say it's actually good to have lots of vaccines in the pipeline because the hope is that there are multiple winners. First does not necessarily mean best, because immunity and vaccines, it's really complicated. It's also why there are a few different types of vaccine approaches being tested. In China, for example, researchers have been focused on a traditional method. It's similar to flu vaccines, where you take an inactive version of the virus and introduce that to the body.
Okay, so where does Moderna fit into all this?
So Moderna is this biotech company in Massachusetts, and it was off to an early start. They were the first to begin human testing of a vaccine back in March, and the U.S. National Institutes of Health had developed it and have been putting lots of support behind it. What Moderna's vaccine approach does is introduces the genetic code of a virus protein, so part of that virus, the RNA, and the idea is that it then tells the body how to build a successful antibody response. This kind of approach is easier to scale up in terms of manufacturing. But the big turn, Carol, is that the New England Journal of Medicine this week published peer-reviewed, as in vetted, results from phase one of that Moderna trial. And those results appear to keep Moderna's place as a front runner.
So what did they find?
So phase one involves a small group of people, in this case about 24 people, ages 18 to 55. And the purpose is to really focus on whether any vaccine is safe in healthy individuals, at what dose, and whether it induces an immune response. And this study found in those individuals, yes, the vaccine produced the kind of immune response they had hoped it would, and that it appears to be safe. The side effects like headaches and chills in these healthy participants, they were mild, though they were there, especially when individuals got this needed second booster dose.
Okay, so do those results mean that this vaccine by Moderna actually works?
No, it doesn't. So Dr. Nadine Rufael is based at the Emory Vaccine Center. She's a director there, and she is a lead investigator on this clinical trial. She says this next part of the trial is all about answering your question.
The phase three trial that will be starting in 10 days is the one that will give us the answer if indeed this vaccine will protect against COVID.
So Carol, brace yourself, because this later phase, it means scaling up the trial big time to include tens of thousands of people. And that is all starting later this month here in the U.S. Companies in Europe and in Asia, they're gearing up for this with their vaccines too. And actually, the University of Oxford in the UK, their vaccine trial has already entered this phase, and they have clinical sites in South Africa and Brazil.
So this is all happening much faster than the typical timeline for a vaccine, right?
Yeah, it's totally high speed. I talked to Dr. Penny Heaton. She directs the Bill and Melinda Gates Research Institute.
To go from a genetic sequence to phase one results in 6 months is unprecedented.
Vaccines can typically take like 6 years, not 6 months, to develop. So it's important to keep in mind that just because you've made it this far in this race, like Moderna has, it doesn't guarantee you're going to make it to the finish line, let alone win it. We still don't know how long, for example, protective immunity might last. And there's just lots of hurdles and potential surprises because this is a completely new virus.
The World's Alana Gordon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thousands of companies that gather data from EU residents online and transfer it to servers in the U.S. may soon face major headaches. Earlier today, Europe's top court struck down a key agreement that allowed such transfers because, the court said, the agreement failed to meet European privacy standards. Here's the World's Lydia Amanalidou.
This data-sharing pact is called the EU-US Privacy Shield. More than 5,000 US-based companies, including banks, law firms, social media companies, have relied on it to transfer data collected in the EU to the US. For many companies, this is part of normal daily operations. In its ruling today, the European Court of Justice, or ECJ, said that the agreement didn't go far enough to protect EU citizens from US government surveillance once their data is transferred here. Max Schrems is an Austrian lawyer and privacy rights advocate who brought the case to the ECJ. He posted his reaction to the ruling online.
So we're super happy about the judgment. It's exactly what we're asking for.
Schrems has been advocating for stricter data sharing standards ever since the Edward Snowden revelations. In 2013, the former National Security Agency contractor blew the lid on the PRISM surveillance program, which allowed the NSA to get access to data from companies, including major tech firms like Facebook and Google. Schrems argued that if an American company sends an EU citizen's data back to the U.S., they lose privacy protections that are guaranteed in the EU because the NSA could access that data.
In Europe, there is a fundamental right to privacy. In the U.S., there is this duty of companies to forward data to the NSA, and that simply clashes.
Schrems actually used this argument to get Privacy Shield's predecessor, an agreement called Safe Harbor, struck down in 2015. Caitlin Fennessy was one of the people who came up with and negotiated the new agreement for the U.S. government, and now she's research director at the International Association of Privacy Professionals.
The reason the Privacy Shield was necessary and the commercial protections it outlined were necessary in the first place is because the U.S. does not have an overarching federal privacy law in the commercial field.
The EU, by contrast, has strong rules about what companies need to do to protect data when it's used for commercial purposes. This agreement, she says, provided safeguards for EU citizens whose data was transferred to the US.
And it also described the protections that exist in the national security and law enforcement spheres.
But according to the ECJ ruling today, those protections just weren't up to snuff. There are other mechanisms under which companies could transfer data, but experts say today's ruling could make it a lot harder. While companies are scrambling to figure out what this means for them, privacy advocates are celebrating today's decision.
This decision by the European Court of Justice is a big win from a privacy perspective.
Estelle Massey is with Access Now, a digital rights advocacy group. She says today's ruling doesn't mean that data transfers will stop.
It's just that there is a list of safeguards that needs to be in place to ensure that when this data move between the EU to the US, that people's information will be protected, people's privacy will be respected, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not about putting a halt to those transfers. It's just ensuring that they happen within a safe framework.
We reached out to several companies that could be impacted by today's decision. In a statement, Facebook told the world it's considering the findings and implications of today's ruling and that it's looking forward to regulatory guidance. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Up next, beating the heat with trees. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. If you're listening to us in Phoenix or Dallas, I don't need to tell you this. It's hot. 111 degrees Fahrenheit in Phoenix today, 99 in Dallas. Climate scientists say record-breaking summer temperatures around the world may become the new normal. Today, we're looking at one way to fight the heat in cities, trees. It's part of our weekly look at climate change solutions, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The world's Anna Kusmer reports on one simple solution to urban heat that's being applied in a new way in Pakistan.
Karachi, Pakistan is another place that's really hot. The high was 100 degrees today.
So living in Karachi without an air conditioner is probably akin to being slow roasted alive.
For Sophia Ashai, who lives in the city with her parents, there's only one thing to do in the summer months.
You lie on your cold air-conditioned marble floor with your cheek right on the ground and you pray that that night will come.
Outside Ashai's house yesterday, kids ran to an ice cream truck. Most of the adults sat on the sidewalk in the shade of big trees. Ashai says that's where people without AC spend most of their time. But there's not a lot of shade to be had in Karachi. Less than 10% of the city has tree cover. And that's something Shahzad Qureshi wanted to change after a deadly heat wave killed 2,000 people in and around Karachi in 2015.
It was just too hot.
So it was just, you know, one of those times where you're like, what the hell is wrong with this place?
During the heat wave, he saw something that inspired him.
And I saw his TED Talk.
A TED Talk by Shubhendu Sharma.
Soon, I started making a forest in the backyard of my own house.
Sharma was sharing a technique of growing dense urban forests using something called the Miyawaki method. It's different than other tree planting approaches.
These forests, compared to a conventional plantation, grows 10 times faster. They are 30 times more dense and 100 times more biodiverse.
The Miyawaki method uses a variety of native tree species and plants them close together using an intentional design. The goal is to establish a diverse, quickly growing tiny forest. Over the past decade, Sharma's organization has helped plant 150 of these kinds of forests in 13 countries.
So I'm very keen on taking this method to every single country of the world.
After seeing Sharma's TED Talk during that 2015 heat wave, Shahzad Qureshi wanted to be the person to spread the idea to Pakistan.
I've been shown this light. If I'm not going to run towards it, then who will?
4 years later, Qureshi's organization has 14 urban forests planted in parks, schools, people's yards, and outside of a mosque. The oldest forest already has acacia trees that tower over 35 feet, full of big branches and birds' nests. And these forests work to cool things down by up to 10 degrees.
I don't even say it to people. I let people actually experience it when they actually walk into these areas that, oh my God, it's much cooler in here.
Trees are well-known solutions to urban heat. They both provide shade and release water, which cools the air around them. But as more people move to cities, trees are cut down and grasses are paved over, replaced with buildings and roads that make cities hotter. And climate change is making it worse. A recent study showed that in 50 years, around a third of the world's population could live in unbearable heat. The increases in heat waves are being felt now, says Vijay Limai, a scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
All across South Asia, we're talking about detecting an increase in the frequency, intensity, duration, and even just the geographic kind of aerial extent of extreme heat risks across the region.
Policymakers in Pakistan have started to look at planting trees as a solution, says the UN's Umair Akhlaq Malik.
But government has realized overall in Pakistan that greening is very important for the country.
Malik says this Miyawaki method of planting dense urban forests could be a good way to green a city that doesn't have a lot of space.
So with the limited city size, with a rapid growing population, and lack of urban space, these sort of urban forests, at least on paper, provides a good opportunity for urban greening.
A good opportunity, but there are barriers to planting these forests, like the upfront cost. Each one could cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And getting the space allocated. Malik is working with Shahzad Qureshi to try to get more people to back the idea.
To take it to scale, you need more practitioners who would invest their time and energy into this.
Malik supports Qureshi and his dream. To have urban trees not just along residential streets, but filling every single park in the city. For the world, I'm Anna Kussmer.
The Big Fix has been bringing you poems from young people sharing their perspectives on the climate crisis. It's a collaboration with the nonprofit Right the World. This week, we have a reflection from Nigeria.
My name is Bianca Nwokeji.
Bianca is a 20-year-old writer in Abuja.
Nature is my number one inspiration and motivation in every aspect of my life.
Climate change is an overwhelming challenge, she says, and writing helps her confront it.
Writing is more than a hobby. It's a friend, a companion, a therapist.
Here's Bianca's poem, Soul Treatment.
Someone once asked me, Bianca, why do you write? On hearing that, my lips arched with a flashed smile and I replied with complete honesty. Ever saw something so wrong but couldn't change it? Ever felt something so cosmic and wanted humans to hear it? Well, that's why I write. I write so that I can make my contributions to Earth. To ease the situations I cannot change, situations beyond my human power. I write so that those cosmic floods of thoughts could be heard, to give them life. But most importantly, I write to build myself, to heal myself, to let out my emotions and get control of them. I write to discover myself, to know how deep my demons lie, to find my strength and weakness. I write to find peace, for whenever I hold a pen to a paper, my soul reaches the altitudinous peak of complete tranquility.
That was Bianca Nwokuji reading her poem, Soul Treatment. Sound design on that piece was done by Uzair Ahmed. You can read other climate change poems and catch up with our solutions reporting at theworld.org/thebigfix. You're listening to The World. The pandemic knows no borders.
It's not possible to build any individual or any country into this kind of bubble. We are all connected.
Our guest thinks visa offers for Hong Kong residents trying to relocate don't go far enough. And speaking of moving, how about escaping to Estonia? Up soon on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. U.S.-China relations are in a downward spiral. According to news reports, the Trump administration is now talking about imposing a travel ban on members of the Chinese Communist Party. Meanwhile, Beijing is accusing Washington of meddling in its internal affairs. The White House has been especially pointed in its criticism of China's harsh new security law for Hong Kong. Another impact of that law, some people in Hong Kong are now actively thinking about getting out. Australia, which is a 9-hour flight away, wants to welcome them. But there's a catch, as The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
Chinese officials say Australia is making a huge mistake, pushing their relationship to a breaking point. What are they so mad about? Well, here's Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
And so Australia today has taken steps to suspend our extradition agreement. We have formally notified Hong Kong and advised the Chinese authorities.
No more extradition treaty. So if someone is fleeing Chinese authorities in Hong Kong, perhaps a protester looking to avoid jail time, they can go to Australia. It's kind of a safe haven now. But fleeing Hong Kong, needing to run somewhere for safety, Did most people think it would come to this?
No. Be honest, no. This is so unreal. The whole thing is so unreal.
That's Jennifer. She was born in Hong Kong. Now she's an Australian citizen with an activist/support group called New South Wales Hong Kongers. She asked that I only use her first name because she's scared of being targeted by the Chinese government. Jennifer says Hong Kong, as she knew it growing up, is done.
The freedom of Hong Kong, like, it's gone. Everything, it just suddenly disappeared overnight.
She and other Hong Kongers based in Australia are hearing from protesters who've been outspoken about the Chinese Communist Party. And now these protesters are asking, should I get out of here? Here's Dennis from a group called Australia Hong Kong Link.
The most important people that we hope foreign countries could save are really those who were on the protest front line, and some of them are already arrested or have been to court already.
Dennis also asked to just go by his first name. He says Beijing's new law casts a wide net against dissenters.
The law mentioned will not be charged because of what you did in the past, but probably what you did in the past would catch the eyeball of the Hong Kong police, which is also putting you at risk.
So Australia, it's looking like a tempting place to flee for certain Hong Kong dissidents. They won't get sent back to China, and people like Dennis and Jennifer are there to help set them up with a new life. But listen to how Australia's prime minister is talking to Hong Kongers wishing to leave. He wants people who are trying to
start a new life somewhere else, to take their skills, their businesses, and things that they've been running under the previous set of rules and arrangements in Hong Kong and seek that opportunity elsewhere.
Yeah, he almost sounds like he's at a job fair. Notice he doesn't use the word refugees. But most people seeking a freer life in Australia aren't fleeing a wealthy city like Hong Kong. Here's Dennis once again.
Australia would like to help Hong Kong as well as to gain some skilled migrants or probably some capital from Hong Kong as well.
What Australia is actually saying, policy-wise, is come on over. If you're a student or business owner, someone with potential, we'll give you a nice visa and a path to a good life here. It looks like a talent grab, and Australia isn't the only country doing this. In the United Kingdom, you have Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Mr. Brexit, not exactly a big advocate for more immigration, saying, we may take nearly 3 million Hong Kongers. Jennifer, the activist, says, look, call them refugees, call them whatever. As migrants go, Hong Kongers do bring a lot to the table.
I'm sure like Hong people come here, we will like make friends, we will work hard, they will bring more jobs and opportunity here like to the locals.
Australia's immigration minister, Alan Tudge, he's trying to attract disaffected Hong Kongers.
Because they do want to be in a freer country, they want to be in a democratic country, and we want to make it attractive for that super talent to consider Australia, and that's what these measures do.
But if you're not super talent, get in the refugee queue with everyone else. In reality, these changes may work for a small number of dissidents, but it's not a lifeline to most Hong Kongers. Beijing is still mad about it and threatening payback, but Australia is gambling that it's worth it. Dennis hopes Australia will eventually make it easier for more disaffected Hong Kongers to come over. But for now, he says, this is a good start.
When Australia is trying to offer a helping hand to Hong Kongers, they would like to screen and choose those who can really make good contribution to the country. And this is understandable.
For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Yangyang Chung says she's troubled by the language politicians and governments are using to promote resettlement policies for Hong Kong residents. Chung is a particle physicist at Cornell University. She was born in mainland China and took advantage of a visa program herself just over a decade ago to come to the U.S. to study. Chung says that move involved trading one set of freedoms for another. Yangyang Chung, why do you find visa offers for Hong Kong residents from places like Australia and the U.K. so problematic?
I believe very strongly in migration as a human right. However, the host countries, whether it's the UK or Australia, and to some extent, some members of the US government as well, they're only seeing the most privileged, the most well-educated Hong Kong residents, the ones who have the most resources, and they're seeing this policy as a way to enrich their own countries. And I found that to be a dehumanizing perspective. The poor, the disenfranchised, the people who do not have the resources, and most importantly, the people who have no willingness to leave their homeland, they're seen as some kind of political chess piece, as some kind of resource that can be extracted.
So your fear is that these visa programs end up leaving behind everyone but a privileged few.
In general, people who have faced the menace of a border, including myself, we have to turn a part of ourselves into currency, whether it is our savings, our degrees, our skills, our labor, and at the very least, it's also our stories, our despair and our pain that are being used to purchase this ticket of crossing. And that is a traumatizing experience. And I do hope that people who have been living in a place of their birth, who can just exist with nothing to prove, recognize that. And I think what the coronavirus pandemic has shown us is that nations and humans are all porous entities. So it's not possible to build any individual or any country into this kind of bubble and exist alone as an island.
It's interesting. One recent survey of Hong Kong citizens found that if Hong Kongers had to relocate, most would want to go to Taiwan. I mean, Britain and the U.S. ranked even below mainland China as a favored destination. Does that surprise you?
That didn't surprise me. People who choose to leave their homelands favor geographical, cultural, and linguistic proximity to their place of birth. The fact that mainland China ranked higher than Britain and the U.S. as a place of relocation is that there are also indeed people who are more conservative and pro-establishment in Hong Kong.
You relied on a U.S. student visa to open the door to what you hoped would be a life of greater freedom in the U.S. At the time, your mother warned you, saying, freedom cannot be eaten like rice. What did she mean?
For my mother's generation, who have never experienced political freedom, but have experienced China when it was very poor, what the Chinese government has found the Chinese people into this binary choice. On one hand, there is material prosperity and social stability. On the other hand, there is civil liberties and political freedom. However, this is not a mutually exclusive choice. And that is where I pushed back at my mother when she suggested that. But I also recognize that she is saying that from a personal experience, as a loving gesture, as a gesture of warning that any kind of dissent or rebellion comes at a cost, that freedom is not free.
I want to get back to this issue of visas being offered to residents of Hong Kong. What do you think Western governments should do when they see Beijing tightening its grip on Hong Kong?
One thing is, whether it's governments or individuals who are used to live in the liberal democratic system, they have often underestimated their power, but overestimated their adherence to principles. I think there are actually a lot of very insidious ways liberal democracies cave to authoritarianism, by favoring market access, by favoring an economic benefit, by favoring some kind of geopolitical calculation. And I think these are the things that governments and individuals need to reflect on, know where to hold the line, where to stand up for the collective values and principles.
Yangyang Cheng is a particle physicist at Cornell University. She grew up in China, but now lives in the United States. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
In Iran, a rare online protest went viral this week. It came in response to three Iranian men being sentenced to death. More than 4 million people called for the end of the death penalty in Iran by tweeting out the hashtag #DontExecute. Peyman Jafari is a history professor at Princeton University. Peyman, why do you think this hashtag #DontExecute has gone viral in Iran? I mean, who's tweeting about it?
These are mainly ordinary Iranians who are angry about the announcement that these three men will be executed. So they want to actually stop the execution. These three men were arrested, one of them at least, around the November protest in 2019. And two others of them fled to Turkey but were returned to Iran. And the charges against them are that they have been involved in burning a bank and having been involved in armed robbery.
But we don't know whether those charges are true.
No, absolutely not. We don't know if those charges are true. And also, they haven't received a fair trial because their lawyers haven't been getting access to defend them. And there are many questions surrounding this whole trial.
Peyman, what were those November 2019 protests about?
Well, the protests started when the government increased the fuel prices and the income of ordinary Iranians had already declined. So this was one last measure that made many Iranians take to the streets.
Iran put more than 250 people to death last year, more than any other country except China, according to Amnesty International. What is it about these three Iranian young men that has caught the public's attention? What can you tell me about them?
Well, in the last years, actually, there has been a growing opposition against death penalty as such. But I should say that the majority of death penalty cases in Iran are drug-related. But these cases are obviously very political, and they come at a moment that the Iranian society is convulsing. There is anger against socioeconomic decline. Unemployment is rising. There is the really heavy pressure of the economic sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Iran. So people feel under pressure. And this is one way of showing their solidarity together and, you know, voicing their opposition as well.
As I understand it, these three men, they've been sentenced to death, but it's not clear when the sentence will be carried out or if it will be carried out.
No, and some of the authorities have actually explained that the sentence is not definitive and might change. And in my view and others' view, this might be actually a reflection of the public pressure on the authorities to actually retract the decision.
Is there a risk for the Iranians who are tweeting inside Iran? I mean, are they risking their own safety by taking part in this campaign?
There is always a risk given Iran's authoritarian conditions and surveillance, online surveillance especially. There is always that risk. But the huge number of people doing this actually diminishes that risk, because the bigger the numbers, the more difficult it becomes actually for the authorities to say, you know, this person or that person has been the instigator of this campaign.
Payman, have you tweeted the hashtag Don't Execute?
I have done so, yes, asking others to show solidarity and draw attention to this case. I have also tweeted something about President Trump, who also tweeted on behalf of these three men. And many Iranians did, pointing to the hypocrisy of trying to defend the lives of these three men while at the same time being pro-execution in the U.S. and also imposing economic sanctions on ordinary Iranians, which is, of course, hurting their daily lives as well.
Payman Jafari is a researcher at Princeton University. Payman, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Like in many places around the world, the West Bank and Gaza are in the midst of a renewed outbreak of the coronavirus. Over the past 12 days alone, cases there have more than doubled. That's a faster increase than almost anywhere on Earth. Dr. Ali Abadrabo is the General Director of Preventive Medicine at the Palestinian Health Ministry. He's in Ramallah. Dr. Abadrabo, you had a very limited first wave of cases back in April, but since mid-June, there's been a very sharp surge in cases. What's happened?
We are facing now, as the rest of the world, the second stage of the rapid spread of the pandemic, and we have increased number in some governorates. The governorates is like the states in the U.S., but a small size here. There is a spread of the pandemic all over the community in these governorates.
I understand the vast majority of these new cases are in refugee camps in the West Bank. Why is that?
Why? Because the refugee camps are overcrowded area of population. So the spread of the pandemic and the infection is higher than other geographic areas.
Is there any possibility of creating more space for the refugees? Are there any efforts to separate people and create the kind of social distance necessary, or is it just impossible under these circumstances?
No, it's so difficult, but we are providing now isolation of the infected people in the camps in other areas. So we take places as hotels in Ramallah city, because there is no possibility of the distance separation between the population in the camps.
The West Bank, as you know, is controlled by the Palestinian Authority, but the Gaza Strip is run by Hamas. Does that split affect the way you're managing the crisis?
No, but the situation in the Gaza Strip is so different because there is a siege since several years in the Gaza Strip, and there is no possibility for the population to go outside the Gaza Strip. So the policy there was to confine all the affected people with coronavirus who came from abroad in the isolation centers. For that, till this moment, there is a few cases in Gaza Strip, but the situation in the West Bank is totally different. In West Bank, we have no control over the borders. We have no controls over the old territory of the West Bank. So we're facing a lot of challenges due to the occupation.
The Palestinian Authority just imposed a nighttime and weekend curfew in the West Bank in an attempt to slow the spread of the virus. What other steps are being taken?
We have to focus our control in the investigation and contact tracing. We have to increase our capacity of the treatment centers and isolation centers. The one thing that can be effective in facing this pandemic is the social distance, and that's it.
Hmm. Have you been receiving aid from the international community?
Yeah, we receive from WHO, from China, from the Arab countries. Yes, we received, yes.
Dr. Ali Abed Rabo is the General Director of Preventive Medicine at the Palestinian Health Ministry. He's been speaking to us from Ramallah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Abortion has been legal in Spain since the 1980s, but in January, the Spanish Health Ministry blocked access to an abortion information website. It's run by a nonprofit that provides abortion pills for free. And Lucia Benavides reports that abortion rights activists in Spain worry the move could set a precedent for future restrictions.
For 15 years, the online platform Women on Web has been mailing abortion pills to people all over the world. The site provides information about abortion in 22 languages, who to talk to, what to expect, and what the different countries' laws are. For those ordering the abortion pill to take at home, there's a detailed video of the process.
When you receive the abortion pills, please follow these steps. First, swallow the tablet of mifepristone.
The site has been banned in Saudi Arabia, Turkey, South Korea, Iran, Brazil, and as of this January, in Spain.
There was no due process of law involved in the process. We were just blocked overnight.
Leticia Zenevic is a human rights lawyer representing Women on Web. She says the organization, with headquarters in the Netherlands, didn't realize they had been censored in Spain until they saw the number of users decrease 63% compared to the same time last year. After an investigation, they learned they had been banned by all internet providers in Spain because of a government court order.
It was the worst possible scenario for women needing to end a pregnancy in Spain.
Abortion is legal in Spain and free of cost under the public health care system, so the censorship came as a surprise. People can abort at any point in their pregnancy, but need medical approval after the 14th week. And pregnancies of under 7 weeks are usually terminated with the mifepristone and misoprostol drugs, the same drugs that Women on Web mail out.
We were blocked under a leftist government in Spain. It goes to show that the right to safe abortion, it has to be protected from all political spectrum.
In an email, a press person for Spain's health ministry said the court order to block Women on Web was done because the site provides medication that is not authorized in Spain. The email says that taking these pills without medical supervision is dangerous and not justifiable in a country where, they claim, there are no legal barriers to abortion. The health ministry says they tried to reach Women on Web several times but received no response. Zenevic, the lawyer from Women on Web, says Spain's health ministry never contacted them. At the offices of the Association for Reproductive and Sexual Rights in Barcelona, a receptionist takes calls from people trying to get access to abortion services. Silvia Aldaver is a coordinator at this agency. She says that legally, people in Spain can't get mifepristone unless it's prescribed by a doctor, so the government can block Women on Web on that basis. But she adds, there are dozens of other websites providing the pills.
Censurar esa web A mí me parece no solo poco estratégico.
Censoring this website isn't very strategic. It doesn't make sense. And it's symbolic, because they're censoring an organization with a long history of fighting for abortion rights.
Aldever says that access to abortion in Spain differs from region to region because of resources and a recent rise in conscientious objectors, doctors who deny abortion services based on moral, religious, or personal grounds. People in rural areas sometimes have to travel for an abortion, and others have a hard time accessing services if they live in an abusive household. The real issue, Aldaver says, is that people in Spain are still ordering pills online because they can't otherwise get an abortion.
Y lo grave es que sabiendo que tú como sistema estás...
The problem is that, on top of excluding women, the system is closing the only other option they have.
Aldaver says this was a political response to local news outlets warning about the online sale of abortion pills. But she worries about the bigger context in which it's happening, as backlash to abortion rights continue to sweep across Europe and the U.S. For The World, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
Shauna Blackman contributed reporting to this story. If escaping home sounds extra enticing to you at this point in the pandemic, Estonia wants you. The small Baltic state is launching a digital nomad visa program next month. It's aimed specifically at non-Europeans looking for a connected place to work remotely. The scheme was the brainchild of Estonian entrepreneur Carly Hendricks, who joins me from Tallinn. Carly, how will this visa work? How do you qualify for it?
The visa is basically targeted to people who are in the digital nomad community, which means they have ability to work remotely. They are either freelancers or they work for an employer in another country. So let's say you're working for Facebook in the United States and you want to go and work remotely from Europe. So you would qualify for that.
I'm curious, are Estonia's borders open at this point?
The borders are open. I mean, there are some limitations in terms of which countries go into quarantine or not. But to be honest, my company navigates in the immigration space. And for not only Estonia, for many of the European countries, there actually has been already past few months, if you are moving to the country with an employment, the borders have been rather open already since May.
How's the Estonian economy doing right now?
I believe there's no country in the world that hasn't taken a hit from the pandemic, unfortunately. But I do see, since you know my company navigates in different European countries, I do see that Estonia was very fast in terms of recovering, opening up. So I think the blow is not as hard as in some other countries. But to be honest, I think it's too early to talk about that. I think we will talk about that more precisely in the autumn. I think that's where we're going to actually see the impact of last spring.
How would you sell your country to Americans right now?
Estonia is a country with an amazing user experience. In that sense, if you just think about complex things that I know are a pain in America, like, for example, doing taxes in 2 minutes or just anything state-related, it's not a friction. Everything happens online. We don't use papers. It's a country with a very low density, meaning there's a lot of nature, there's a lot of space, and everything that is human connected is digitalized. So everything works and is simple.
Now, I'm curious, would a digital nomad visa enable an American to travel throughout Europe, throughout the 26-country Schengen zone?
It does, but it has the limitation of 3 months. So basically, you can't spend in other countries, in other Schengen areas, more than 90 days. So that limitation still applies.
Estonian entrepreneur and the force behind the country's new digital nomad visa program, Carly Hendricks. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.